Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with musician, actor, author, and punk rock icon John Doe. When John Doe decided to drive from the East Coast to Los Angeles in the early 1970s, his big career plan was to get the hell out of Baltimore. He didn't know if he'd find the music scene he was hoping for out west, but if he didn't, he knew he'd start it himself. That DIY ethos was the foundation of the punk movement, and of X, the band he founded with Billy Zoom, Exene Cervenka, and DJ Bonebreak. Their darkly funny songs, unsettling harmonies, and wild visceral shows scared some and thrilled others. And as someone who grew up in that time and that place myself, they had both effects on me. And John's music also made me realize music could be a path to questioning authority and making your own art in your own way. X went from playing in a living room for 40 people to playing sold-out shows at LA's legendary Whiskey A Go-Go in just a year, before they ever released an album. And when they did, records like Los Angeles and Wild Gift sold tens of thousands of copies. Still, record labels and the media didn't know what to do with them. So John and X, along with so many other punk bands, did it themselves. And 40 years later, X is still playing to crowds of thousands when they reunite for tours. On top of that, John has gone on to have a career that includes 11 solo albums, 60-plus film and TV roles, and a fascinating book about the punk scene that he mostly got other people to write. We'll get into all of that, and you'll also hear how his songwriting has evolved, what he thinks his job really is, and a few personal details that would have made him a bit less scary to an aspiring young punk from Fullerton, California. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, John.
Hey, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Sure.
You know, it's an honor to have you here. And I wanted to start with a quote that I read that you said, which is what happens when people mention your band X. Mm. And I think you said there's one of two responses. Either it's that band changed my life, mm-hmm. or who?
Right.
Yeah. And I was definitely in the former category growing up. And in fact, I wanted to bring this along and show it because this was the record I got from my cousin Mo when I was in eighth grade.
Good old Mo.
Good old Mo. And Mo lived next door to me, and he was sort of responsible for influencing my taste in music.
Yeah.
And he got me this record and some Clash records around the same time. And I can honestly say that listening to your band at that time and the Clash and a few other bands, it did change my life because it opened up the possibility that I could play music, that I could learn about history and politics, and I could start questioning authority, and yeah. It sort of gave me my independence. So imagine my surprise when I ran into you a few weeks ago, and right. I find out you're doing the 40th anniversary tour of X.
Ay, ay, ay.
And it just made me feel so old.
Well, not as old as us.
that's right.
So you got that going
yeah,
for you.
Yeah.
Well, there was maybe upheaval in LA, but it was kind of in the air. That's why I think it all happened so quickly. You know, within a year or something of the Ramones going to England, then there was all those bands and my parents lived in Brooklyn, so I would go visit them from Baltimore, and so I saw the Talking Heads and, you know, Heartbreakers and stuff
right.
like that, and then thought, well, this is all set.
Right.
So I'm going to go to L.A. because I liked all the writers that came from here and stuff. But it was just in the air, you know. And we owe Boston and all those, Peter Frampton and all those, what we consider kind of terrible records, a great debt. Because if it wasn't for all that excess and wheedly, wheedly, wheedly and virtuosity and, prog rock and all that bullshit, then it would be like, we wouldn't have had anything to like fight against.
And, right.
And so it's a good place to be in between Who and You Saved My Life. I actually have met a couple of people recently where literally saved their life. Like they, and then they, somebody called them and said, you got to hear this band.
Really?
Yeah. There's a woman in Baton Rouge and a couple other people that said, you saved my life. And it's like, okay. That's a pretty heavy thing.
Yeah.
You know, to be discussing at the merch table.
Yeah. So it's,
what do you do? What do you follow that up with?
Would you like to buy a t-shirt?
Cool. Want to buy a shirt? It's like, fuck. Yeah. It's a weird world.
Well, it's funny because one of the things about punk rock for me is that the music turned me on so much because it was so different. And yet the culture was kind of scary. I was a really little kid and
yeah.
The whole
you
thing was
been
a little
scared.
Bit scary. Yeah, yeah, exactly. But I was thinking, you know, I was curious about when you were young, what, like, how you got turned on to music, what you started performing, and what made you want to play music in the first place.
I guess because I've always been a bit of a ham.
So you like performing specifically?
Yeah. I'm really lucky like that. I have a number of friends who are, you know, great songwriters and singers, and they don't really necessarily like going on tour or singing in front of people and stuff. The television was off, you know, and the screen would reflect. I would kind of like dance in front of the television and like look at my shoes and think like, I'm like five or something.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's good. Oh yeah, that's good. It's like, but, you know, kids of the 60s, which is I'm one of, you know, when I was like grade school, that's when the British invasion came in.
Right.
And then I would sing and my mom sang and not professionally, but, you know, she was a really good singer. And so I kind of got good pitch from her maybe. But I liked it, you know, and it's like you can do it. And then you have a foray into, like, people will say, oh, you were in a band, or you, you know.
So were you in bands when you were pretty young?
Well, the first performance that I ever gave was at a, in second grade, singing I Love You, A Bushel and a Peck.
Really?
Yeah. I love show tunes as well.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Bye bye, I'm talking to my eighth grade self now going, you didn't need
that's
to be so
bullshit.
Scared of these people. They were into show tunes.
He was a junkie when he was 10.
That's right. Well, I think there's some, you know, because the first time anyone sees you, they see you in Decline of Western Civilization or on stage at the Mask or in, you know, the Unheard Music. And
right.
And that part is not being touted.
Well, because in 75 or 76, whenever you became aware that there was something called punk rock or that just it was just different. It was kind of a line got drawn, and then I had to forget all of the tricky stuff I was doing when I was learning how to play bass and go, oh, wait a minute, it has to be even simpler than that, because you're talking like viscerally rather than intellectually, and so you drew a line and said, okay, I'm putting all that stuff aside for now. And luckily there were, you know, 100 other people that were doing the same thing, so you could be inspired by Fear or the Germs or Screamers or Weirdos or all the other bands that were there. So it was like, it was really easy to say, no, that was then, and this is now, like right fucking now.
Right.
Luckily, Billy Zoom and DJ and I had, and Nexine to a degree, had this musical history that was kind of backing up that stuff. We knew that we'd played longer, but it didn't matter. It really didn't. It wasn't an intellectual choice. It was kind of a emotional, personal choice of, I'm not going to play everything I know. I'm going to play what is meaningful, like real shit rather than stuff that is fancy.
What made you have the confidence that that was okay?
Everybody else that was doing it.
And how did that? Okay, so
you know,
so
we weren't the first punk rock band ever.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
So there was the Ramones, and then oh, there's this band Iggy and the Stooges, which nobody except in Detroit. And then there's the MC5, and there's Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers, which that first record was really influential here. And
right. Saying
he was just doing it really simply and. Yeah, and it appealed to all the stuff that I had heard, like country western records, blues records, which I listened to a lot before coming here. Yeah, I didn't want to do that. That was old, and I wanted to do something new. And holy shit, there's a whole bohemian culture that's happening here. This is great.
That's so interesting because a year or so ago, you put out a book called Under the Big Black Sun, which sort of chronicles that intense period in Los Angeles between maybe 76 and 81. You talked about how in that book how you got to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I was curious about your sort of career plan going towards Los Angeles. Like, what was the plan?
I had no career plan. Are you kidding me?
Well, you had enough of a plan to get in a car and drive there.
Yeah, my plan was to get the fuck out of Baltimore.
Yeah.
That was my plan.
How'd you pick Los Angeles?
Because, like I said, New York seemed kind of set. You know, there were all these posters that, you know, are wheat-pasted, like Television and Blondie, and I saw the Talking Heads, and I could tell that, you know, there was a big scene happening there. And I was sick to death of the East Coast.
Really?
You know, Baltimore especially is like, oh, no. Oh, no, you can't do that. Well, I just went, no. Somebody else tried that. Somebody else went out to Hollywood. No, it didn't work.
Did you hear some of that?
Oh, of course. All the time. It's like, you're from Baltimore. No. And it's like, you know what? Fuck all of you. I'm out of here, and I'm going to go see where it doesn't sleet. I'm going to go see this place that they call the Golden State. And I thought, well, if something's happening in New York like it is, then maybe something like that could happen in L.A., although there was no signs of it, and it was kind of beginning.
God, you know, you talk about it like, hey, I didn't have a career plan and stuff, but it seems sort of visionary to go, New York's set, I'm going to go to L.A., and maybe a scene will start.
No, I mean, career plan, those two words never entered my head. I'm pretty much like, yeah, you know what? I do have an ability to see things and envision things and have that like deep feeling that like, well, this is going to happen. And
really?
And then kind of make it happen, yeah.
What do you think that comes from?
You know, maybe it's just like confidence that was, because I had a pretty good childhood, more or less. I don't know what it is, but I could see, and I had an idea that I could be in a band that was as good or, you know, had the same kind of respect as the Velvet Underground. I thought, well, that's where I want to go.
So when you come out to Los Angeles, You're living in Venice. You take a poetry workshop. Find out so much of this book. I love this book. And you meet Exine in the poetry workshop. Did you have a strategy or a plan? Like, did you know what you were doing when you took a poetry workshop? Did you know it was sort of going to be a lyric building exercise or did you just?
So I went to school in Baltimore at Antioch College and graduated with a Bachelor of Arts in like poetry and American literature or something.
Again, eighth grade me is going, never would have guessed that.
But in the key is to take all that learning and to push it aside and figure out, like, where do you want to go?
Right.
And so maybe the song Los Angeles is influenced by Charles Bukowski's dead simple, like, small words, tell a story, get out. So when I moved to LA, I thought, okay, well, where can I find kindred spirits? Because musicians are just all over the place. But
right.
Poets, you know, say, oh, I'll just go to this. And, oh, this poetry workshop in Venice has been going for a long time. And, you know, Bukowski went in there a couple times. And Tom Waits went there a little bit. And it's like, oh, I'll go to the Venice poetry workshop, you know. And Exine had just gotten a job, some government program to learn typesetting. And that's why she was there, because she lived above Beyond Baroque.
Oh, okay. So Beyond Baroque. Just geographically,
yeah.
She was,
I was
there.
Like, oh, I'll just walk downstairs. It's Tuesday night. What the
no
fuck?
No kidding.
Yeah. So that's why you say career plan and like strategy and stuff like that. There was nothing. There was no fucking nothing. It was like, there's no strategy to the band. There's no strategy to like moving out here. It's like, oh, I'll just give this a shot, you know. But it was fate. I don't know.
Well, like, and yet you managed to pick up three of the most unique people in the punk rock world at that time.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about all the other bands that appear sort of at that time at the Mask and these places, the people you managed to connect with were pretty special in their own way.
We had good fortune in that none of us stepped off the curb and got hit by a bus or got so into drugs or alcohol that we killed ourselves. Because we didn't, you know, Billy likes to say that, you know, we never made enough money to kill ourselves or retire. So that's why we're still playing.
There's always the future.
Yeah. There's always your golden years.
Yeah. Well, so what's fascinating about your story to me is the Recycler. Because for people who didn't grow up here in Southern California, the Recycler was a paper. It was the Bible for me at mm-hmm. a certain age, because that's where you sold a car. It's where you bought a microphone. It's where you bought an amp. And it's also where you found band members. And that's how you guys met, which I think
that's
is
how Billy and I met. Yeah.
It's how Billy and you met. And right. and so tell me when you met Billy, did you immediately know, okay, now I know what I'm doing. I found a kindred spirit. And
you know, Billy is like someone from outer space.
How so?
He's cut from a different mold in a great way. You know, he can build an amp, and he can rebuild a engine in a car, you know. So, you know, he's got a science mind.
Right.
So I like that. It's like this guy is different. I did feel like this guy knows something that I want to know when I met Billy. But he didn't like playing leads. He didn't like jamming. And I thought, fucking A.
Yeah.
Jamming for a bass player sucks.
Yeah.
Because basically you get a bass line and then everybody else goes, woo, and they're playing all this other bullshit, and you're going like, ding, 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 ding.
Yeah, exactly.
Fuck that. That's no fun.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and I like songwriting, and so playing songs is cool. And he was opinionated in like, well, that's all bullshit. All that music that has been going on that's, you know, coming out of L.A. and Fleetwood Mac, you know, post-Peter Green. No. And I was like, cool, I'm in.
And then when you bring Xene into the band, what did you tell her about punk rock, or what did you tell her about what you were doing? You know what I mean? Like, how did you get her into the band?
I didn't have to tell her anything. She knew it. She knew it all. I didn't have to tell her much. But the way that she got in, you know, the way that I kind of said, well, here, why don't we have this other element, is because I didn't want to go it alone. I didn't want to be like a front guy. That's scary. So, and also, you know, she had written this song, I'm Coming Over.
Yeah.
And I said, well, what if I did this in this band that I'm kind of trying to put together? She goes, hell no. This is one thing of value that I have. You are not going to take that away from me. If you want that, I come too.
Really?
And so I thought, well, this is cool. You know, I'm infatuated with you, and I think you're a real talent, and you have all the markings of of a lead singer, which is like, you know, all of her childhood and, you know, some of the demons that she's had, and, you know, it's like, yeah, this could be good. And then, you know, we just worked together, and it was like, oh, this is like, we can do this weird thing where I'm writing for you and you're writing for me and we're kind of like a team. And
well, the makeup of the band is so unique, and the sound that you two made together was so unique enough to me that you invented it. I mean, something about your harmonies were different than other harmonies I'd ever heard on record.
Because Xene hadn't played in other bands. She didn't know, like, sing a third and then go to a fifth or whatever, you know, or sing, you know, so we'd sing unison and then she'd sing just something she made up. It's like, okay, I'm going to sing that because that's what I hear.
Yeah.
But then she would sing the same thing, and people would say, that's out of tune. And she would sing the same thing, and it would be like a, I don't know, flat third or something, you know, but she'd sing the same thing. It's like, no, I mean to sing that. You know?
Right. It's not,
it's not an accident.
Well, so, gosh, when that first record came out, it drew me in because, songs like Nausea and Johnny Hit and Run Pauline were they were scary and dark and weird, and the picture on the inner sleeve was scary and dark and weird. And yet, like, the songs worked on me really well. Like, the choruses worked, the bridges happened. Yeah. And, you know, at a certain point, I saw the decline of Western civilization, which I wasn't supposed to see because I was too young.
That's right. And whoever was saying you shouldn't see that was actually trying to keep you from going down a dark path.
That would
but
be
it seemed
mother.
Like it turned out okay, so that's good.
So when you decided to write this book a couple of years ago, did you go back and watch Unheard Music or watch The Decline or anything?
No. I read some books and I just thought and, yeah.
What was the impetus for writing the book?
Pressure from a friend of mine and my sweetheart and saying, you should write a book. And it's like, fuck. No, you should write a book. And sounds like too much work. That's why, you know, that's why I want to do this. It's like, I don't have to work that much. I just play. I go out at night and I play.
Well, so once you got into it and you said, okay, because I'm assuming you gave in to
the pressure. No, what happened is they kept bugging me about, you should write a book. And I'm not like a raconteur kind of person. I'll, you know, tell a story now and then, but it's usually short. And then they said, but you should write a book. And it's like, oh, fuck. So 2 years into that, then I thought, I know. I'll get everybody else to write it. I'll be like Tom Sawyer of punk rock. We'll paint the fence. Yeah. Yeah. The idea was, though, that L.A. and I'm sure New York and I'm sure, like, Minneapolis and every other place that has a scene, it's all community, it's collaboration, and that's the reason that it's like a scene.
Right.
And I thought, okay, well, who can probably put some words together? And I'll use this original idea that the scene had, which is collaborating, community, and then we'll make a list. So the other friend is Tom DeSavia, who I wrote the book with. And, you know, he wrote the preface, and I wrote, like, chapter in the front, and then a couple in the middle, and then a bunch of in-between stuff, and one at the end. And so I'm kind of the narrator. And and then I thought, well, Jane Wheedlin from the Go-Go's, lived at the Canterbury. And that's where everybody exchanged their ideas, and that was our salons.
What a chapter that is, too. The Canterbury Tales is a wild chapter. Yeah.
Yeah, she's the only one that we had to change names.
Oh, really?
Because the legal department at DeCapo said, you're going to get sued. I don't know. Do you want to get sued? I think you don't want to get sued, so you better change that name. He's still alive. You can't say that. And then Dave Alvin, you know, he's a really good writer. You know, Henry Rollins is writing about what it was like for a kid from D.C., which had a really small scene, coming to L.A., and it's like, oh, these kids are really serious. They just went and just rolled a guy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And he said, you know, he was just working at Haagen-Dazs, you know, like fucking 8 months before that and gone to prep school. And, you know, but suddenly he's like, holy shit. They're serious out here. Well, okay.
You know, when I read that, I was happy to find out that Henry Rollins himself was a little scared of the L.A. scene.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that it never was embraced by the mass media. Because it was scary.
Yeah.
And it was, people took drugs and people were dangerous and they meant it. And then, you know, years later when it's like hair bands and stuff like that, and they're on the Sunset Strip. It's like, oh, that's just cartoon shit. That's fine.
Right, they were tame
the women, yeah, the women dress like prostitutes, and the boys are, they don't have a brain in their head, so just leave them alone, they're fine. Right. These other guys, these could be dangerous, so let's you know.
So when you started getting all these essays back in from these people, how did it sort of affect your memory, or what effect did it have on your memory of the time?
It was just a different perspective. And it jogged a few responses when I would do the interstitial pieces, you know, reading Teresa Corvarubias' piece about East L.A. It's like, oh, I remember at Club 88 when suddenly there's like all these really handsome and beautiful like teenagers that are like Latino. What the fuck? Where did these what? And it was like overnight in 78 or something like that.
Right.
It's like suddenly they're on the scene. And it's like, oh, they've got a band, and there's Los Illegals, and there's The Brat, and there's The Stains, and, you know. I mean, Tito and the Plugs, you know, Tito's from Mexico City. And so they were, you know, it was all inclusive and stuff like that. But suddenly there was this whole East LA element. And
right.
That appealed to our, like, feeling that it was bigger than just, you know, some disaffected suburban white kids.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, our music can relate to this whole other culture. And, you know, and they had a deep culture in rock and roll as well.
But the idea that everyone was welcome, and then it seems like the scene sort of ended when the music got very aggressive and very white and very, you know, violent, I guess.
Yeah. Well, everything changes. And at the time, I mean, you were talking about the decline of Western civilization, and as that when that came out, we were mad because there had been this other scene that wasn't really documented. They didn't have good footage of the Alley Cats or the Plugs or the Screamers. So wait a minute, this weird, like, anything goes kind of scene, that didn't get documented, but this is getting, you know, this is getting a spotlight. But, you know, Penelope Spheris made the movie that she could get made, which was being a little sensational.
That's
being
right.
Kind of like, oh, these kids are nihilists. And, you know, that kid with the X shaved in his head,
yes.
He was a fucking sociopath.
Totally. Totally.
I mean,
he is scary.
Yeah, he was an ex-military, like got kicked out of the Marines or some. You know, I'm sure he's dead. But, he, you know, I stopped a couple of concerts when he was swinging a big chain around his head in the middle of an audience. It was like, get this fucking guy out. But that actually is, you know, in retrospect, The Decline is a great document because it shows that transition.
So did your parents ever see The Decline of Western Civilization?
I don't think so. I don't think they'd be interested in it. But they said, okay, you go and do your thing, and this music stuff is really hard.
Like, did you ever were you estranged from them, or were you, did you have your issues, or were you always close to them?
No, we had our issues, like any, you know, healthy parent, child. I mean, it's different now because kids and their parents are see things a little more similar, maybe, but they said, okay, go do that thing. They would help me out if I got really broke, if I didn't have another instrument to sell. But they were supportive, but they didn't really think it was going to work.
They didn't.
And then when there was a review in the New York Times that said, oh, this band is actually good, they were like, well, that's very nice, John. I'm so glad that your rock and roll band has done something. They're kind of effete. They were really educated and they love classical music. And, you know, my dad was a head librarian in Brooklyn. And he was like, he did work for the man. But he hid away in the library system. That's another story. You can, you know.
Well, this would have been great information for me to have when I was in eighth grade.
Oh, no.
When my mom said, you know, these people are going to, you know, they're all on drugs. They're all going to, you can't go see them. You can't, you know, and
she was
and
right.
If I could have said, look, see that guy? His dad's the head librarian. That guy. He's got a college degree.
You would have abandoned us. You would have said, that's bullshit.
I would.
That's not rock and roll.
I would have.
That's fucking horseshit.
I think that scene in The Decline of Western Civilization, and you were tattooing somebody.
Yeah, Top Jimmy, I think.
Like home tattooing with just.
Yeah. And we were high on speed.
But I could see.
You forget to say that.
Well, okay.
And we had also played two shows at the Whiskey that night. And we had agreed to have Penelope film us at this tiny, tiny duplex where Exine and I lived on Genesee Street, and she put tinfoil on the windows so that we could film until dawn, and then we did. We played two shows, unloaded the gear, went back to our place on Genesee, and said, well, what are we going to do? We can't just party. Oh, we'll have tattoos. So we did, and we had tattoo parties before that.
Right.
We were out of our minds. We were out of our fucking minds. We were being bohemians, and taking the risks and being outlaws and saying, fuck it, man, deal with it.
You talk about in the book a chapter, almost like a beginning of the end, and this is a story I didn't know, but I think right after you and Exine got married, you were playing one of the last shows at the original Whiskey, and Exine's sister died. She got hit by a drunk driver on the way to see the show. But would you throw a chair through the window of the Whiskey? Or?
Mm-hmm.
I guess I was curious about reading that, about why that moment stood out as a chapter ending.
Well, it was, I guess maybe things were headed that way anyhow, because heroin was coming in pretty strong, and that made people kind of disappear into their, nether world of that. And we're really lucky that it didn't affect us. I mean, we dabbled and, went up to that edge and went like, oh, wow, this is pretty cool up here. And then like, whoa, and I think we're going to go back in. I'll go back down here a little bit. Just down here. But with Exene's sister, she was in a car and somebody ran a stop sign and she was killed instantly, we think. And we had played one show at the Whiskey and it was sold out. So there were two shows and we found out in between, and like fucking idiots, we played the second show. Somebody, I think it was actually Danny Sugarman from the Doors fame.
Yeah, manager,
or infam, I don't know what Danny was. He was like, began as the fan club guy and then, anyway, he kind of managed Ray, and he bought a bottle of whiskey from the bar. And we just drank it all and then played. And if I had that to do over again, I would have said, sorry, ladies and gentlemen, the show is canceled.
Yeah.
But we didn't know what to do. It's like, oh, there's all these people here. I guess we're supposed to play.
Yeah.
So we did. It changed everything because up until that point, we didn't realize that life was so tenuous. And I was so connected to, and still am, so connected to Exene. It's like that was her mentor. That was her, big sister, who was like the best big sister you could have, and taught her a whole lot of things, a whole lot of stuff about art and style and things like that.
Was there a moment around then where you sort of looked at the entire lifestyle and said, I'm going to decide whether to be, self-destructive or whatever? Like what direction am I going to take out of this?
Yeah. But we we still continued to test the boundaries.
Yeah.
But I think maybe around that time decided, well, maybe not so flagrantly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. God, it's a fascinating time, and I think that it was, for me as a kid, loving the music and going to some shows, and it was scary, it was exciting, it was exhilarating, but it, like you said, looking over the edge, there were people who didn't look over the edge, there were people who just dove mm-hmm. over, and they're probably all gone, or they're probably extremely yeah. affected by that, and gosh, you've had this whole career beyond that world. You have this whole other life as an actor that's kind of amazing. And I dove into it a little bit more in the last week, and I watched Roadside Prophets. And another film that I never saw that was really fascinating came from one of my favorite This American Life stories called Please to Meet Me.
Oh, yeah.
And going back and seeing some older things like Pure Country, which I thought you did a great job in Pure Country.
Earl Blackstock,
the drummer.
Yep.
So let's go back a little bit. Tell me how acting started for you. How did the first gig happen?
I can give all the credit or blame to Allison Anders. She was doing Border Radio, which actually is part of Criterion's
collection
thing. And it's really beautiful. And they were using musicians in L.A., and she asked me if I'd do it, and it was fun.
And before that, did you have any ambition to act?
No.
Or?
No,
nothing.
Mm-mm. And then what happened? I loved movies. And,
yeah.
But Allison was so encouraging, and they just let us. She had just worked with Wim Wenders. She had interned for Wim Wenders on Paris, Texas.
Okay.
And there was a lot of improv in that. But that was fucking Harry Dean Stanton.
Right.
Right. He knew what he was doing. We had no idea what we were doing.
So she you do a lot of improv as well.
Yeah. It's like, just making up shit. I was like, what did I, okay, we're going to do that again. Oh, shit, what did I say?
Right.
I got to say, oh, you mean I have to say that again? I have to say the same thing again?
What a thing when you think about it.
It's like, ay, ay, ay.
People who work their whole life to audition and get a part in a film and everything, and they've had improv training and they've had classes and everything, and you just sort of land in the middle of that.
Well, the stakes were pretty low.
Yeah.
And it took about 2 years to make it, and she would call me up and say, "Oh, so we're going to shoot again this weekend. Can you bring that blue plaid shirt that you had?" I said, "Sure, yeah, no problem." Which blue? I've got three blue plaid shirts. I think it was that one. And so there's one scene where I like walk into a room, and then walk out to two different shirts completely. Yeah, the stakes were pretty low.
But did you come out of that saying, "I want to do more of this"?
It was rewarding, and I didn't have to rely on an audience to say, "Yay, good job." You know, you knew if it was good or not. You know, it was nice to have Allison say, "Oh, that was good." But with an audience, you can feel like you're killing it, and they're like, "Yeah, whatever." It's Sunday night, I'm bored.
Right.
You know. So it was actually when I worked with Harry Dean on Slam Dance, which was a terrible movie. Oh, my God. I don't know. It was just too ambitious. I was trying to do too many things. But I was working with Harry Dean, and we only had, you know, a handful of scenes together. But I got to hang out with them, and I valued that time. And the scenes that I was doing with them, I realized I was getting buried. I was getting so left in the dust, and I just, fuck, what? Oh, my God, this is like, he's on a whole nother level, and what am I, oh, shit.
Was that like finding out what you didn't know?
Yeah.
Like that you didn't know what you didn't know?
Yeah.
But I would think it would be a daunting thing to go, okay, I don't know anything about this, and I have to kind of start over.
Yeah. Sure. I don't know. Let's go give it a shot. See what happened. But nowadays, what's really fun is doing all the research to kind of figure out who the character is. You know,
right.
It's very rewarding, and then getting paid is good too.
Well,
that's about as deep as I go.
Yeah.
Except finding the character and figuring it all out. I mean, that's cool because you get to have like a weird inner life kind of thing, and you kind of like, oh, how would he walk? And you know, make all this. Actor decisions.
So you learned you had to figure out, like, that's a different way to think, right?
Yeah. You know, being on a stage playing music is a lot of exhibition and you know, without being too dumb. You know, don't do anything that you're going to be embarrassed by. Or maybe go to the... enough. Go far enough so you might be embarrassed, but don't truly embarrass yourself. And then... But the acting stuff, you have to like get the, you know, wheels turning, and then that influences your ability to tell a story when you're recording, because that's also can be pretty small, and you can hear the details.
You mean recording music?
Recording music, yeah.
All right, so acting has had an influence on songwriting.
Yeah.
I wondered about that. If you, when you started acting, if it also changed the way you looked at songwriting.
Well, that was something that Exine and I always, we made a secret agreement. It's like, we're going to tell the truth, and we're going to tell what we know. So when we were writing songs that had to do with her sister, she didn't really want to do that, but we had kind of made a deal. It's like, okay, well, this was part of our, big part of our life, so we kind of have to do that. And I don't know that acting really... or developing characters really, I think developing the character for a song came first, and I could apply that to acting role.
Okay.
So it refined each, you know, both refined each other. I think it has something to do with authenticity within a fantasy. Because, you know, like art and music and acting is all sort of artificial, but if you bring a authenticity or like a genuineness, a kind of grounded feeling to all that artificial stuff, then people will go, oh, seems like he means that, you know?
I'm kind of fascinated about this secret pact, this idea that there was an ethos attached to the way you and Exine wanted to tell stories.
Yeah, well, I mean, her lyrics are a little less linear. They're more wordplay, but we started out by telling the stories of like life as a bohemian.
Right.
But I don't know that we actually ever said, okay, here's the secret pact.
Well, we're gonna do stuff that's really uncomfortable, and it's gonna be hard, but we gotta do it, you know.
But we did kind of feel that, like, this is not a job for the faint of heart, and being an artist is, that's what you gotta do. You gotta, you know, expose yourself and be vulnerable, and if you're talking about how much you love someone, which I did in, like, maybe more solo records, or with Exene and I, and it's like, you're a sissy. Stop talking about that love shit. That's sissy stuff.
Does that voice go through your head?
No. Yes.
Yes.
No. Yes. No. Yes.
Yes.
No. Sure. But I don't care. It's like, tough shit. You know, people will say, oh, I cried when you sang that song. And I think, yes. Good. I'm glad.
But,
and then I call him a sissy.
You call him a sissy.
He's sissy. Because that's, you know, it's the best thing that we get to do is you get to, like, someone says, well, my sweetheart said, so what's your purpose in life? And I said, to make people feel cool. To make people feel a little better or a little worse or a little cooler than they were 2 minutes before. And it's like, that's a good job. That's a great job.
That's
like, people go to an X show and it's like, I'm fucking cool. I came to an X show. Or maybe they don't. Maybe some of their friends go like, that's bullshit. Those guys are old. Those guys were cool in like 1980. You're living in the past. But I don't care, you know? I mean, if you feel something, and if that's my job, just like, hey, that was, I feel a little cooler or a little like something more. Like, that's a pretty good job. I like that job.
Yeah. You know, I'm curious about the songwriting process. How do you get out of your own way and not write the same song or not fall into the thing that you know works or the chorus that somehow in your brain says that's a chorus? And I wonder if there was a point where you had to figure out consciously, like, mm-hmm. how to evolve as a songwriter.
And it's being inspired or experimenting or trying a new method and not being satisfied with just what you did. But you make a great case for the 45-minute long set.
What do you mean?
I think that most songwriters, most bands, most everybody, it's like, if you play 45 minutes, you can really run the gamut of what you're capable of.
Right,
and
right.
If you play 3 hours, God bless you, Bruce. You're probably going to sing some songs that are like the one that was like in hour one.
Right.
You know?
What never gets any easier about writing songs for you?
Finding something a little bit different about it, you know? In your first 20 songs, it's like, oh, I can, it's Eddie Cochran, like, down, down, down. And then you can use that 2 or 3 times, and then it's like, oh, I can't use that anymore.
Right.
It's like, but it's funny, I mean, the germ of it is still the same. It's like, oh, yeah. When it clicks, when you have that, like, moment of discovery. And sometimes, you know, The most successful songs lately have been all at once, you know?
Really?
Yep.
They just hit you all at once.
Just kind of boom, yeah.
Do you think that's the culmination of working at the craft for so long that it happens, or do you think that's actually, as you get older, learning how to be an innocent receptor?
I think the latter.
Really?
Being intuitive about it. Because, you know, the perspiration is there in editing. The inspiration is, you know, the biggest part of it. And it's just a moment. And sometimes you have to put it aside and wait until it gets better. And I screwed up a couple songs.
By not waiting or by not trusting?
Like, I'm going to get this done. And yeah, fuck that. Now I'll just wait.
Do you think with age comes the ability to be less critical about what it should be or what it needs to be, or
yeah, I think so. I think well, age is like I'm very grateful for getting here and being as in good health and all that kind of stuff as I am. And once you get there, you have this feeling of like, oh, it's going to be fine. It's going to be just, well, maybe it's not going to be fine. Oh, no, it's going to be fine. See, I if I just waited a little bit, it was better. But after having done it along a bunch, you know, written a bunch of songs, then I haven't written a song in like a year and a half, but I'm not worried about it.
It'll come when it comes.
Oh, when I say, okay, now I'm going to, and then you kind of get your mind into this free floating, like, and you don't really care whether the oil gets changed in your car, and you have to be careful about that, but you get into just put yourself into a weirder place.
There's no one goofy telling you when it has to be.
Yeah, it's just goofy, but it's just yourself, you know, telling yourself that it's okay. Oh, good God, it's 2018. I guess I better write a song.
Well, okay, but that brings up a really valid question about the business or the economics of being an independent artist. Mm.
Well, I'm really fortunate in that people will come see me, you know, and whether it's playing to 150 people, if I do a solo show in, you know, a like smaller city, or if it's 2,000 people and X is playing in a bigger city. So I'm really lucky, very fortunate.
You know, it was so interesting watching the Unheard Music, seeing this sort of quasi-conversation take place between this MCA record executive and the guy that ran Slash Records. And for anyone who hasn't seen the Unheard Music, it's sort of this fantastic thing because on one hand, it's this massive desk and this MCA guy with his sideburns and his tie, and he's discussing a band, I think, Point Blank.
Point Blank.
Point Blank. Yes. And they had so much success with Journey, and now the entire company of 900 people is really high on Point Blank because... And then they're discussing about how it just doesn't make any sense to release a record by X because basically he's saying because we would have to actually do work to introduce them to other cities where they're not known yet. And then you cut to the guy at Slash and he's got a Budweiser in his hand and he's gone, hey, I like him and I don't see the problem. But, you know, I wonder if those early things set the die and it sets you on your path.
We didn't want to be part of any MCA big desk, corporate bullshit. If they wanted to come to us and say, hey, we like what you're into, man. Why don't you come along and we'll have a meeting? Then we'd say, sure. Because we wanted to be the next version of rock and roll. And then, you know, it got fucked up and you know, some people said, fuck all you media people. We don't want your slimy. And it's like, no, wait, don't, no, oh, shit. Oh, well, I guess we'll just have to toil in the trenches.
You think that was it? It was actually that?
I think it was, yeah. I think it was like, you know, and I don't know if it was just Johnny Rotten or Sid Vicious or whatever, but it's like, we're here to destroy rock and roll. And then all the media people said, oh, you want to say fuck you? Well, how about this? How about fuck you? And you're out. And you're out.
Right.
But no, we didn't want to have any part of the big desk. And we didn't. We were here to change corporate mentality of that. And if Bob Biggs was there with Slash Records, then awesome. Yeah, we wanted people to come and drink our Kool-Aid and, you know.
Do you feel a bitterness towards the music business in general?
Although I do think they got what they deserved.
You do.
Because that arrogance and you know, overblown, like, actually the best thing you can do in a record company of that era is not make a decision. Because then your job is secure. If you say, I'm going to put my money on Point Blank, and then Point Blank stiffs, then you're out of a job. But you're probably going to fail upward. You'll get hired by some other company at a better salary. It was just, so they eventually, you know, kept sticking their head in the sand and saying,
oh, this file sharing thing, that's horrible. You know, you can't do that. And
and then they got killed by it. And so I think that, no, I don't have any bitterness. I'm really fortunate to have a gig.
Well, I
wake up every day feeling that, oh, God, I opened my eyes. This is awesome. This is really good. This is a good thing. I think at the time we probably felt like, God damn it, we're not getting what we deserve. But we got a lot of coverage. We got a lot of coverage from New York Times and the LA Times, and we were on Dick Clark's American Bandstand.
Funny enough, you can see the interviews, but not the performances on YouTube.
Well, American Bandstand was all lip synced, which said, oh, that's fucking bullshit.
But I was so surprised to see you on talking to Dick Clark three different times, I think like 82, 83, 85.
He had a crush on Maxine. That was pretty awesome.
It was pretty.
But the best
obvious
story that she tells about Dick Clark is that he, like maybe the second time we were on there, she's getting her makeup done, which she's feeling like a queen, like, someone's doing my hair and makeup. I don't really care, but this is fun. And then Dick Clark comes and sits next to her, and she's going like, holy shit, it's Dick Clark, oh my God. And then he goes, so tell me, Maxine, you guys are doing this, you know, it's like the new version of rock and roll, and it's like, why aren't you guys, like, why isn't this taking off, and why isn't it more popular? And she goes, I don't fucking know. You're Dick Clark. You tell me. You know? It's like, we're trying the best we can, and nobody wants to give us a fucking break, you know?
See, that's the thing. When I found those Dick Clark videos on YouTube, it really made me remember back then that I think there was that promise that maybe the bands that I liked were actually going to become the bands that everybody liked. And,
yeah.
And I was always really sort of bummed out when bands that I loved didn't catch on. Like, why didn't I hear The Replacements on the radio?
But it was, you know, here's Ramones and Blondie, doodly-doo, and then here's X and the Weirdos and the Screamers, doodly-doo, and then suddenly Black Flag and all the SST bands says, actually, these guys are bullshit, and we're not going to play their game at all. We're going to do our own game, we're going to make SST records, and we're going to sleep on people's floors, and we are going to develop a network of places you can play. And they're going to be here and there and everywhere, and you know. And we weren't willing to do that. We wanted to sleep in a hotel, and we wanted to get paid.
Right.
But they did the true missionary work, which led to like the Replacements, and then the Pixies kind of took advantage of that, and then college radio was actually something.
Right.
And then Nirvana came along with Soundgarden and PJ and stuff like that, and it's like, boom.
Yeah.
And all the people at Geffen are going like, what do we do? I don't know. Print more records. Did you do something? No, I didn't do anything. It's just the people. Oh my God, not the people. They're unreliable. What the fuck? Print more records.
Exactly. But you know, you're right. There was a groundwork laid. Like, I think when you guys started to go out to tour, there was whole states you couldn't go to and book a show.
Yeah, the first out-of-state gigs we did were in New York, because Xene's sister set them up at CB's and Max's Kansas City and someplace called Studio 57, which I guess was like across the street from Studio 54. I don't know. But we drove from L.A. It was 78. We just put out adult books, and we're desperate, and we drove from L.A. to New York and played three shows, and then
And you drove all the way back.
And then we played one show in Shanksville, Pennsylvania.
You're kidding me.
Uh-uh.
Is that an Amish town?
I guess. It was right around Christmas time, and I remember somebody like wrestling a Christmas tree and being all punk rock on a Christmas tree in this fucking bar. It was sad.
No, but you know, what you say is that's right. There was no network.
We didn't know. I mean, maybe there was, but we didn't know.
Yeah.
But I give the, you know, DIY, like down and dirty, hardcore punk rock bands a lot of credit for developing that network.
Right.
Yeah.
In the idea, you know, the punk rock philosophy or the ethos, do you think that some of those early successes set the die for the way you live your life to this day in terms of you built something out of nothing and you know you can do that?
I think it's really hard to continue if you don't get some positive reinforcement. So the fact that, that we went from absolutely nothing to playing two shows at the Whiskey in a couple of years, or even in a year, that there were, you know, three times our audience, that was a lot of, and then the fact that that was a lot of positive reinforcement.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I do think it set the die.
Yeah.
But creativity is just, it's something that you either put into your house, making it nice, or you write a song and that's good, or you figure out a character and you try to be honest and daring. And so it's just like how you kind of shift that creative thing.
Yeah, you know, we ran into each other a few weeks ago. You were playing a benefit for skate parks, Tony yeah. Hawk's Foundation, and he's a giant X fan, and we all ate dinner, and then there was, what, 75 people there maybe, and we went into this living room type area, and you played these songs that I'm sure for most of the people in that room meant so much, and it just struck me as, what a life, like the community that is created through that kind of music, it really appealed to people who did want to do things their own way and mm-hmm. make their own projects and not sort of deal with the big desk.
Right.
And I wonder how that looks reflected back to you.
It looks really good. And I didn't realize that until actually talking with a friend of Billy Joe Armstrong, who said, when they started playing, I thought, I don't want to work for somebody else. I'm going to start my own business. DIY business, not DIY punk rock band. And he's got a huge tattoo parlor. And I didn't have, it didn't even dawn on me that the fact we're doing some DIY stuff and saying, you know what, man, I don't want to work for you. I don't want to work for the man, that somebody else could say, I'm going to start my own business.
Yeah.
Fuck all this other bullshit. I can do this. And yeah. In that way, I'm pretty proud of anybody who's done that and shown somebody else the way to say, yeah, what could happen? You could fall flat on your face and then you go work for the man. I don't know, but you can try it. And I still feel that way.
Yeah.
Like anybody who plays guitar, if they're like, no matter what age it is, and I'm carrying a guitar and somebody goes, oh, do you play professionally? And I say, yeah. He said, I used to play guitar. And I said, well, why don't you play now? You should go home and play. Because whether you play for, you know, 10 people or 1,000 people or whatever, if you play music in your own room and it like, did that feel good? Yeah, it did. I bet it did. And your soul gets a little deeper and you feel a little bit more like, I just played that song. That's pretty cool.
You know what?
That's.
I think your job is going around making people feel
is.
A little cooler.
It really is. Because you can start playing guitar at any point in your life, and it could be great.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's been a great honor to talk to you. And I owe you a thank you, because honestly, somebody whose music and work influenced me and feel partially responsible for being here today, so.
Well, I appreciate it, and appreciate the opportunity to blow a bunch of hot air out there and just say, I think that this is so.
You know what? Who better than you to do that? I trust you more than most people
sure,
in the world today.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes, sure.
You got me somewhere.
Good. I'm glad to be of service.
Thanks for doing this.
You bet.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening to our penultimate episode of the year. I love the word penultimate. For anyone who doesn't know what it means the second to last episode, which means we have one more episode next week. And before we get into talking about that, do yourself a favor and go back and listen to the early X records. They still sound amazingly fresh and vital and vibrant. Also, if you haven't seen The Decline of Western Civilization or X, The Unheard Music, those two documentaries are a great primer to find out what the Los Angeles punk scene was all about. And then you can read John Doe's book, Under the Big Black Sun,
and you'll get a full picture of that time. And it really was a fascinating time. So check all that out. And also, don't forget to check out offcamera.com. If you haven't seen our website, it is a full archive of every show we've ever done. And through our monthly subscription, you can watch Off Camera to your heart's content, on any device, anytime. If you haven't experienced the show visually, it's a great way to get an even more in-depth look at these conversations. So check that out. And also stop by our store. The holidays are fast approaching, and we have some great, really unique gifts that you can give to your friends, make them all feel a little cooler, and support the show at the same time. I would recommend our new book, Off Camera, The Portraits, which is a 275-page coffee table book full of black and white photographs of every artist that has appeared on the show. If you only listen to the podcast, you may not know that after we film each episode, we go into my studio and we do a photo session with each guest. And that's my way of kind of making a complete portrait of the artist. And this collection of photographs is really a statement about who these artists are. And it's a great collection and a great way to sort of get behind the scenes into what the show's all about. So check that out. Like I said, it's 275 pages. It's printed in beautiful four-color black and white, and it really is a great companion to the show. And best of all, if you order the book right now, it'll be a signed first edition. So do that, and you can get 10% off by entering the code OCBOOK at checkout. So there's no better time to support the show and do a little holiday shopping. Another great way to follow the show is to check us out on social media. We are Off Camera Show at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I am Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram and Sam Jones on Twitter. Or you can send me an email. I'm sam@offcamera.com. Send me your guest suggestions, ideas, comments, criticisms, or just holiday greetings. I want to also penultimately thank everybody. So let me tell you about our staff here. First off, there's Crawford Shippey, our producer, who works tirelessly to put someone interesting in the chair every week and keeps the whole show running. We have Laura Kemper, who manages the entire studio. Nathan Shields, who makes us sound good and look good and finds a way to make these conversations last exactly an hour. There's Michaela Galvin, who does camera work, graphics work, and makes a mean pie if it's your birthday. It might go in your face, but she puts her heart into it. There's our crack researcher and wordsmith, Amy Jones, who makes us sound a little more clever each week. And our ace transcriptionist, Cara Johnson, who takes all these words and types them at like 120 words a minute. And finally, our esteemed janitor and resident poet, Matt Davidson, who, even if he's in the middle of plunging a toilet or painting baseboards or doing any number of things that keep the studio running, he always has time for a limerick. Usually it's about a man from Nantucket, and he keeps us all in good spirits around here. So thank you, Matt, and Merry Christmas to you. And now that all the penultimate business is out of the way, I want to tell you about next week's guest, our final guest of 2017, and a show you absolutely must not miss, because I am joined by Neil Patrick Harris.
I think what is unique about us is what makes us fun. I did Rent the musical, and I'm this super white kid from small town New Mexico. So suddenly I'm surrounded by this glorious tribe of gypsy people, of all sexualities, of all experiences. I just thought this is what life is for, is to be around people that have stories to tell, to embrace being a misfit.
He's been acting in TV and movies since the age of 15, is a veteran of the stage, and has hosted every major award show you can imagine. In fact, if he ever hosts the Grammys, he will be the one and only EGOT hoster. He's since added producer, director, and author to that list. Neil joins me to talk about overcoming the personal and artistic challenges that came with fame, what an East German transgender rock star taught him about self-acceptance, and his most humiliating stage experience ever. He also talks about the hidden lessons in his new kid's book and why he hopes his own children will grow up to be misfits. See you next time, off camera.